are very conscious of the need to protect and really be respectful of the native villages.
The Fairbanks Diocese looks at leasing Seward Peninsula land for geothermal development. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 24th of December. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, not getting home for the holidays as travelers are still stuck in Washington.
We'll start thinking about extra flights over the next few days as long as we can maintain our regular schedule.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Support for APR and coverage of the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
The unusual snowstorms that hit Seattle and Portland beginning December 19th forced the cancellation of 450 Alaska Airlines and Horizon Air flights. Airline spokesman Paul McElroy says thousands of people have been stuck at West Coast airports because of the heavy snow and strong winds in the Pacific Northwest. Rebooking all those travelers is a major challenge. While airline travel is generally back to normal, not everyone will make it home or to their holiday destination by Christmas. McElroy says the airline is considering additional flights.
We'll start thinking about extra flights over the next few days as long as we can maintain our regular schedule.
McElroy says the airlines have called in every available agent to work overtime. He says call centers will remain open 24 hours a day until all Alaska Airlines customers are accommodated. McElroy says thousands of gallons of aircraft de-icer had to be used over the weekend in both Portland and Seattle.
The amount of de-icing fluid we use does vary on the weather. If it's heavy snow or unusually cold temperatures, we're going to use more than if it's just right around freezing or a light snow. And because we've gotten repeated snowfalls here, adding up to a foot or more in most locations, that certainly has caused us to go through our supply.
The air carrier started running low on de-icer, and the bad weather hampered shipments.
We were supposed to get several deliveries, one by rail and a couple by truck. The deliveries by truck were stopped at one of the mountain passes here just east of Seattle. And the shipment by rail, the switches on the rail lines were frozen, so they had to get crews out there to chip away the ice by hand before the rail car could get through. So anyway, we did run low, but we got more shipment in Monday, so we have a sufficient supply, and we have several more deliveries scheduled over the next few days.
Called one of the worst winter storms in decades to hit Seattle, the town itself has been paralyzed. McElroy says he's been working from home this week, unable to get to Alaska Air Group corporate offices. By yesterday afternoon, the major highways were clear, but many other streets remained clogged. The Alaska Department of Health and Social Services today issued a 60-day provisional license to the Rain Dance Corporation, the troubled former owners of the Mary Conrad Nursing Home Center in Anchorage. Department spokesman Greg Wilkinson says the license is very narrow in scope and allows Rain Dance to deal with financial and clerical details.
Basically, what it allows us to do is have Rain Dance pay their employee salaries and pay vendors, and then get reimbursements, get funds coming back in from Medicaid and Medicare, and that's all.
The state seized control of the facility on December 18th after an inspection found conditions at the facility that presented an immediate danger to the health, safety, and welfare of the residents. Wilkinson says conditions are much improved today.
We've had the opportunity over the past 8 days to have our staff, along with members of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman's Office, go in, visit with every resident, review every resident's charts, talk with their family members, work with the staff, just making sure that everybody there is getting the very best level of care that they can get.
Wilkinson says the Rain Dance Corporation has so far been cooperating with the state as they search for a new owner for the facility. New owners will have to be approved by the state before the center is released from state management. The Fairbanks Catholic Diocese wants to sell or lease land with geothermal potential on the Seward Peninsula. The diocese plans to put out a request for proposals in January for development of land it owns at Pilgrim Hot Springs, about 60 miles north of Nome. Diocese Deacon and Financial Director Greg Bowder says the church has fielded a lot of interest in the property.
we've had a number of parties over the years that have approached the diocese about the possibility of developing the geothermal energy, and then other parties that wanted to come in and produce a historical and a tourist center similar to Chena Hot Springs.
Bowder says the Pilgrim Hot Springs property was tied up in a long-term lease until this month. He says a judge presiding over the church's ongoing Chapter 11 bankruptcy found that the leaseholders, a group of Alaska businessmen, failed to live up to a development stipulation and rescinded the lease. Bowder says a new lease or sale could generate money for compensation of the hundreds of people who have filed sexual abuse claims against the diocese. He says the church also sees other potential for liquidation of the Pilgrim Hot Springs property.
Not only does this bring an income stream to the diocese and help us get through this bankruptcy, but whatever is done, we are very conscious of the need to protect and really be respectful of the native villages, the surrounding people from that region, so that this will benefit them.
Bowder says those benefits could come in the form of energy, tourism, and agriculture. He says the University of Alaska Fairbanks, which drilled geothermal test wells at Pilgrim Hot Springs in the early 1980s, is renewing its research to better define the area's energy potential.
Reevaluating that data, and that may further confirm, at least give some more precise locations of what they call a geothermal source.
Pilgrim Hot Springs was deeded to the Fairbanks Diocese by an early settler who ran a roadhouse on the property in the late 1800s. The diocese operated a home and school for orphans of the influenza epidemic on the land in the early 20th century. Bowder says the diocese is not aware of any abuse happening at the facility. Several buildings, including a chapel, remain intact on the site, which is listed on the National Register of Historic Places. The diocese may issue a separate RFP for preservation of the buildings and an adjacent cemetery. Pilgrim Hot Springs is road accessible from Nome during the summer. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, delivering gifts for the needy in Anchorage.
To take the food and the toys to their neighborhoods where it's easy for them to access, that is why we chose to go with this model.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Tech Cominco and the Red Dog Mine, encouraging listeners to tune into AK every weekend. Check your local public radio station for airtimes.
Support for APRN coverage of the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood comes from Penn Air, offering scheduled charter services throughout Alaska and the United States.
On Monday, Anchorage agencies, churches, and other organizations combined forces to distribute children's gifts and holiday meals to individuals and families in need. Gift has been an Anchorage tradition since 1995. And this year, the need was greater than ever. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
It's about 15 minutes before the first gift shoppers will enter the Mountain View Recreation Center's multi-purpose room. Near the rows of toy-bearing tables, Major Doug Tollerud of the Salvation Army is briefing a dozen stocker elves.
We have boxes that need to be unwrapped. While you're waiting in line, while one of them is basically meeting the customer need, if the other one can open up the boxes and pull out the dolls. We have about 100 dolls that are in boxes that need to be taken out and displayed.
Mountain View was one of five gift distribution centers operating Monday afternoon and evening. Tollerud expected it to be one of the busiest.
1,000 families we are anticipating coming through just this location. Actually, I think it's more for Mountain View. I think 1,200 is what they're anticipating in Fairview, 1,000 in baggage, 700 in both the south side and the west side of town.
Before his stockers took their positions, Tollerud stressed the two cardinal rules of neighborhood gift, no matter how big the crowd.
We got to keep the lines moving, as she was saying, and we got to keep the Christmas spirit, which is all important.
Moments later, Salvation Army envoy Donna Bakke began uniting shoppers with their grocery cart pushing guides.
These are just food. All right, just food. And Helen is next. And Helen, there are eight children. You have a 0 to 2, 2, 3 to 5, 1, 6 to 8, and 3, 9 to 12. And Pauline, you're going to be with this gentleman, William, and he has five children.
I'm 3,500 miles away from home. This is the furthest I've ever been away from my family.
Erin is a military wife from Missouri whose husband just transferred to Fort Rich. They've been in Anchorage 2 weeks. After driving through Canada and receiving little reimbursement from the Army, family funds are extremely low, with parental apprehensions for the holidays very high.
It was really a blessing for me, my children, and my husband. It was really nice.
What age are the kids?
10, 8, and 4 and 4. They helped me, and they were very, very nice to me.
Neighborhood Gift represents a holiday alliance of the Salvation Army, various agencies and churches, the Marine Corps' Toys for Tots, and Food Bank of Alaska. In the recent past, Gift operated from a single location, the ACS, or Alaska Communication Systems, warehouse. Yesterday, at the Fairview location, the food bank's executive director, Susanna Morgan, explained how organizers wanted to reach out directly into neighborhoods.
My biggest concern is making it easy for people in need to get the assistance that they need. So to take the food and the toys to their neighborhoods where it's easy for them to access, that is why we chose to go with this model.
Okay. Number four.
Let me go get number
five. Number five.
Yeah, no.
Okay. Number six.
Which of the five locations shoppers went to depended upon their zip code. Like the annual Thanksgiving blessing, proof of residency was the single qualifier. Only one adult did the shopping. Mostly it was the mothers. Children waited in a secure area. Donna, mother of a 7-year-old, had just finished selecting a toy and, along with her guide, was moving to the holiday meal portion of the Fairview operation. She said from the time her daughter was 3, the two of them had helped serve meals at the shelters during the holidays.
We're going to be helping out this year, too, in Anchorage, but we're also here to get a little, not just give.
Like everyone leaving the toy tables, Donna's cart had a large black plastic bag containing and obscuring a Christmas gift for a daughter who this year hadn't expected a present.
No, she does not. That's a total surprise I didn't expect, actually. She's going to be a little spoiled with a Barbie something or other.
The first estimates of Monday's neighborhood gift distribution indicates the hundreds of volunteers served more than 4,100 Anchorage families. That's approximately a 30% increase over last year's total. The food bank normally figures an average of 4 members per family. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
The National Geographic Society has named Sitka as one of the world's top historic destinations. The Society's Center for Sustainable Destinations has compiled a list of 109 historic sites, including ancient Nara, Japan, Sydney Harbor, Australia, and downtown Boston. Sitka is the only Alaska community on the list. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
The list was published in the November-December issue of National Geographic Traveler magazine. In a nod to the growth of ecotourism, the Society's Center for Sustainable Destinations has published 4 previous lists focusing on community commitment to environmental stewardship. Now, with World Heritage Tourism also on the rise, the center has decided to recognize communities that have strong ecological values and also have maintained social and cultural integrity and authenticity. The National Geographic Society reaches millions of people each month with 5 magazines, books, and videos. Jim Dean is the associate director of the Society's Center for Sustainable Destinations in Washington, D.C. He says the Society likely influences people's travel decisions more than any other media organization. Dean says the Center for Sustainable Destinations was born in 2002 out of a need to approach that responsibility thoughtfully.
Done well can bring a lot of benefits. It can help to conserve and preserve our sense of place. Tourism managed badly and done badly can destroy a place. So caring about destinations, caring about geography is what we're all about. The mission of National Geographic is gathering and disseminating geographic knowledge, and mission for the Center for Sustainable Destinations is to help foster destination stewardship and the world's great tourism places.
The list of historic destinations was compiled through a Delphi survey technique where several hundred panelists rate sites based on six criteria and produce a final cumulative score. Deanne says the list ranks communities, but the ranking is not the most significant information on the list.
What's more important for us is the score that Sitka got was 68. Basically, it's, you know, a 0 to a 100 scoring system, and the highest places, you know, are, you know, Melka and the Vakau in Austria with an 88, and Ontario Canal Corridor of 84. You know, those are the higher ends. And then the lower ends go, you know, dip down to the 20s and 30s. But I think what's most important is Sitka is among those places that are considered to be doing well.
The survey criteria include both measurable tangibles, like the condition of historic buildings and archaeological sites, and environmental and ecological quality. But equal weight is given to intangibles, aesthetic appeal, quality of tourism management, and outlook for the future. Unlike other magazine rankings Sitka has appeared in, the National Geographic list of historic destinations does not gloss over some of the community's struggles with tourism. The panelists' comments are, in some cases, brutally candid. Their observations celebrate the solemn and beautiful Totem Trail in Sitka National Historical Park, the state-run Sheldon Jackson Museum, the Russian Bishop's House and St. Michael's Cathedral, the New Archangel Dancers. But they also warn travelers to avoid downtown Sitka when cruise ships are in. One panelist described the ships as the bane of the town, those Walmarts of the water. Panelists suggested visitors go beachcombing or visit the Raptor Center when ships are in. Another panelist describes Sitka's downtown shopping scene as poor quality shops sprinkled with several excellent examples of Pacific Northwestern art and Tlingit heritage. Deanne says Sitka experiences the same pressure of small cruise ports all over the world. He warns that communities that develop too much infrastructure dedicated to ships run the risk of either being overrun or loved to death or being caught in a down market with an overinvestment in an industry that has moved elsewhere. Deanne says that many visitors go by default to wherever the tourism industry decides, whether it's Machu Picchu, Antigua, or Sitka. He believes sustainable destinations attract visitors through their own initiative.
Sitka needs to, as much as it can in the face of the cruise ship industry, take control of their destination, decide how much is too much, what do we want to benefit from this, are we looking for a short-term windfall or for a long-term sustainable business model and proceed accordingly?
Deanne says the National Geographic Society's efforts to draw attention to historic destinations around the world is a way to spread the wealth to ensure that no one site is trammeled by a new class of geo-travelers. He's aware that visitor bureaus around the world usually measure success by a headcount. The Center for Sustainable Destinations scorecard for historic places is intended to support communities, like Sitka, that have much to offer, but also much at stake.
In general, the fewer visitors you have to a unique destination, then the higher your destination stewardship score in general. And places that are, you know, noteworthy and highly visited, whether that be by convenience or by history, are definitely more threatened.
The 2008 Destinations Rated list is available online at traveler.nationalgeographic.com. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
BP Alaska. BP, where training Alaska's future workforce is a priority.
And by the Alaska Community Foundation, encouraging listeners to tune into AK every weekend. Your local public radio station has airtimes. APRN brings news about Alaska to public radio every day. APRN, we cover the stories that impact the lives of all Alaskans.
Every year, Toyota sends teachers from around the United States on trips to different parts of the world to help them to develop creative, internationally inspired projects. This year, Unalaska High School math teacher Chris Border joined 29 others on a trip to the Galapagos Islands. KUCB's Ann Hillman has the story.
Math teacher Chris Border traveled over 5,600 miles from one small island in the Pacific to another to see how they compared.
And I really felt that the Galapagos being a, you know, remote Pacific island of volcanic origin with lots of pristine natural beauty, that there were a lot of parallels that I thought I could draw and help my students kind of see that even though sometimes we maybe feel like we're really remote, there's a lot of things we share in common with other parts of the world.
What he found on his two-week trip were a few similarities and a host of differences. The Galapagos Islands lie about 800 miles off of the coast of Ecuador on the equator. Unlike the Aleutians, which have been populated by humans for about 9,000 years, the Galapagos were only settled about 100 years ago. People went to the islands in part to develop a tourism industry that focused on the abundant wildlife and beautiful landscapes.
The people have to kind of become part of the landscape versus defining the landscape around them in terms of what they want.
People live among penguins and tropical birds, giant turtles crawl on the beaches, and sea lions nurse on the docks. But Border explained that the people also had to develop infrastructures for the human populations to survive, like farms, schools, and recycling centers. Small cities developed, which led to some pollution from litter, septic systems, and fuel supplies.
The more tourism there is, the more the growth. And so, you know, that was something that we addressed and tried to talk about as a group on our trip, was this issue of just by going here, we're making this problem here worse.
He also witnessed the problems brought on by invasive species like insects and goats. Border said the problems were similar to those in the Aleutians. Some species were brought accidentally. Others were introduced.
But the goats, for example, were used as food and milk supply. And so, you know, a few of them get loose, and then, of course, you have a major problem on your hands if nobody addresses it right away.
Now, the Ecuadorian authorities are being extra cautious about what gets onto the islands.
And they actually fumigated our airplane while we were on board. They hooked up a hose to the cargo hold where all the luggage was and fumigated that, and then they came through with sprays, and they sprayed all of our bags and they sprayed the area we were in too.
The government is also limiting the human population growth. People need special visas to live and work there. Border said interacting with the people on the island was one of the most important elements of his trip. He spent time with local teachers, seeing how they use their limited resources to help the students. Border said he's going to incorporate many of the lessons he learned about the Galapagos, the animals, and the way of life into his classroom and into his worldview.
We shouldn't look at just the Galapagos as the place we have to preserve and protect, but we should look at the whole planet through that same lens.
In Unalaska, I'm Ann Hillman.
The Fish and Game Advisory Board took comment last week on proposals related to herring in Sitka Sound that will be considered by the Board of Fish in February. One of those proposals is to increase the subsistence egg harvest quota levels. It was met with considerable discussion. KCAW's Bonnie Sue Hitchcock reports.
Sitka Tribe of Alaska says the current amount of herring eggs or roe set as reasonably necessary for subsistence does not adequately address subsistence needs. Tribal Council member Mike Miller says the current amount of 105,000 to 158,000 pounds was based on very little data from 1996 and 1997. Miller says it was always seen as a temporary number.
So as part of our deal with the Board of Fish to proceed, we said, you know, this isn't indicative of what the harvest really is. But they came back and said, we have to work with the numbers you presented. What you have to do is we'll work with 30% either way, the number that we have. When you get better data, you go back to the Fish Board and present that data. And you raise the number.
Since 2002, STA and Fish and Game have conducted more thorough surveys, and in the ensuing 4 years where subsistence users reported their needs were met, the numbers were significantly higher. The proposal asks that the subsistence level be raised to between 265,000 and 325,000 pounds of herring spawn. Miller also points out that the use of subsistence herring eggs is not limited just to Sitka.
And the one thing that was missing from the initial harvest surveys, was what other communities use. And so we've had feedback from started outreach to other communities that use herring eggs from Sitka. The data, I think, from 11 communities so far is 111,000 pounds that they feel that other communities would use necessary for subsistence.
In fact, he says Sitka Sound may be one of the last places in the state for subsistence harvest of roe on branches.
Somebody from Barrow, a guy wanted herring eggs, so I took him herring eggs. He sent some whale meat down. A guy from Nome called for a fundraiser. They would need herring eggs, so I sent some of there. So the number, you know, was pretty heavy before used in Sitka. But as we're doing increased surveying, we're finding a bigger and bigger percentage of the eggs that are going out.
Advisory board member Eric Jordan says he supports the subsistence harvest and would even support a higher threshold, but he does have some concerns about how it could possibly impact the commercial fisheries if the low-end number is raised and the subsistence harvest isn't met.
So that's why I'm concerned about raising the lower end. In other words, I'm all in favor of you getting all the fish you want, but I'm not so sure that I want the commercial harvest driven by whether or not you get your subsistence harvest.
Fish and Game Area Management biologist Dave Gordon was asked how the proposal might impact the commercial fishery.
Really find it difficult to manage to around the subsistence fishery. I mean, we have done everything we can to, you know, try to stay away from some of the core subsistence areas. You know, there's many examples of years where we haven't fished anywhere near those areas, and yet there still seems to be some difficulty in achieving the desired harvest of roe on branches.
The advisory board all agreed with the higher quota for the subsistence harvest and voted unanimously to support the proposal. Sitka Tribe of Alaska also has a proposal into the Board of Fish to cap the guideline harvest level for the Sitka Sound sacro fishery at 10,000 tons and that the harvest rate percentage be not more than 10%. Except for members Eric Jordan and Mike Baines, that proposal was not supported by the Fish and Game Advisory Committee. The Board of Fisheries will hold its 2009 meeting in Sitka in February. In Sitka, I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We'd love to hear your comments about the show. To send us your thoughts, go to APRN.org, scroll down to the bottom of the page, and click on the Contact Us link. Be sure to let us know if we can use your comments on the air, and if so, how to pronounce your name. We had reports tonight from Len Anderson in Anchorage, Ann Hillman in Unalaska, Rosemary Alexander in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Bonnie Sue Hitchcock and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. We'll be back on Monday, and we hope you'll join us. From all of us at the Alaska Public Radio Network, happy holidays. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Wells Fargo, financial pioneers in Alaska nearly a century ago, bringing Alaskans to the next stage. WellsFargo.com, the next stage. And by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at ArcticWireRope.com.
The Alaska Giving Coalition announces Pick, Click, Give, a whole new way to reach out and help Alaskans when you apply for your PFD online. Share part of your dividend with some of your favorite Alaska nonprofits. It's a chance for all of us to come together and give a little extra. Remember, when you apply for your PFD online, just pick, click, give. Information online at pickclickgive.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Giving Coalition.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.